Welcome to Wild Earth Radio. I'm Zoe Blunt, and today I'm speaking with deep ecology author Derek Jensen about his most recent book, Endgame, The Problem of Civilization. Derek Jensen is visiting Vancouver and the Sunshine Coast April 18th through 21st. He'll be discussing the need for action to stop this culture from destroying the planet.
What do you want?
You've talked about, and I agree with this, a world where every year there is more salmon.
What do salmon need to survive? They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop.
Derek Jensen, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Your book, Endgame, has been getting a lot of attention, and you write that civilization and the civilized continue to create a world of wounds. Why is it so difficult for some people to contemplate the end of civilization?
I think that, well, two things. One is, I think one of the reasons is because we identify more closely with being civilized beings than we do with being animals who need habitat. And another way to talk about that is that if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, then you will defend to the death the land base and that river because your life depends on that. And right now, that brings me to the third part of this, which is, like any good abusive system, this system is made dependent upon it. And another thing, important thing about the whole question of abuse having to do with this is that one of the things that happens within any abusive dynamic, and that's true whether we're talking about an abusive family or an abusive culture, is that everything, and I mean everything, in this dynamic is set up to protect the abuser. And so every member of an abusive family comes to identify more closely with the abuser's feelings than they do their own. If you look at all the solutions, in quotes, proposed for global warming by anywhere, all of them, what do they take as a given? They take as a given industrial capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the baseline. The baseline is not the real world, the real physical world, which must be the baseline for all of our decisions. Because without a world, you don't have anything. I've got a new slogan, which is protect your land base. You can't have sex without it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the complaints about Endgame, and most of the hate mail, frankly, that I've gotten about Endgame has not come from people who think civilization will go on forever. Most of it's come from pacifists and lifestyle activists. And one of the jokes I've started making is that I should write a version of Endgame called Endgame for Pacifists, which would be 1,000 blank pages and one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the only thing that they're hearing in the entire book, or the only thing they're reading in the entire book. All the other analysis goes by the wayside because they see that, it triggers them, and they can't think about anything. And I've gotten a lot of hate mail from both pacifists and also lifestyle activists who get very upset when I suggest that that we need to do more than live simply.
Mm-hmm.
That there are power structures. It's like I was a pioneer a few years ago. This was so frustrating because there's all these people talking about all these, you know, wonderful ways that people can have more sustainable agriculture, or more sustainable buildings, or anything else. And I was the only person there that I know of who was talking about either power or psychopathology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can all, you know, talk all we want. We can all fantasize all we want about these, you know, groovy eco-socialist utopias, but we know what the dominant culture does to sustainable cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It destroys them and steals their resources, steals their land.
Right. You said you can't make peace with an abuser. You'll lose the peace as surely as you'll lose the arguments. And that's the problem that you have with civilization and that we all have. We can't make peace with this civilization.
I keep thinking about this line by Red Cloud, talking about the whites. He says, they made as many promises more than I can remember, and they only kept but one. They promised they would take our land, and they did it.
Right.
It's relentless. It's utterly relentless.
So why don't more people fight back?
I think the first reason is because most of us are insane.
Mm.
You know, most of us identify, as I said, more closely with the system than we do with our own bodies. I ask people at every talk I do, I say, how many people here have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 70 or 80% of the people raise their hands everywhere I go. And of course, cancer is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of our total environment. And that's how close it gets. You know, this is people's mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, lovers. This is people themselves. I have a disease of civilization, Crohn's disease. It's a horrible disease. And it's a disease of civilization. And you know, how close? There's a question I keep asking. How close does it have to get before we fight back? I mean, every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Okay, that's one reason that more of us don't fight back. Mm-hmm. Another reason is, as I said, we've been made dependent upon the system. We don't know how to live. Another reason is because we're all, so many of us are so afraid of the natural world. I mean, I live 3 to 4 miles from my mom, but I walk back and forth all the time. And there's bears all over the place in this forest, and people say constantly, gosh, aren't you afraid? There's only one person dies in all of North America every 2 years because of a bear attack.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in the United States, 46,000 people die every year because of automobile crashes. Mm-hmm. But we can't see that. We don't see that. Life is not so scary and horrible. I mean, that's one of the things we're terrified of, the natural world.
Yeah.
And that's another reason we don't defend it, is because we think that without the system, we couldn't survive. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, the Talawa Indians on this land I now live, they lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myth of science, without destroying the place and without being killed by all the nasty, mean, horrible grizzly bears.
Right.
And so that's another reason we don't fight back. Another reason we don't fight back is because we've all been taught that civilization is good. We've all been taught that progress is good. And we don't even think about these things. And another reason we don't fight back is because non-humans don't matter. I mean, they're just trees. They're just board feet. They're just dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So what if some little rat disappears? So what if some little, you know, so what if some stupid fish can't adapt to this culture? I mean, it's because we're all really narcissistic. And another reason we don't fight back is because this culture is based on a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is often invisible. We don't even see it at all. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy, those higher, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. I mean, and this is true, you know, within families, you know, if there's an abusive family, like in my own family, my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head, he broke my sister's arm, he raped my mother, my sister, and me. But the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than at a time because the violence was going, he was committing blasphemy, the violence going in the wrong direction. So we can't even conceive of fighting back. And then there's another thing, too, that's very, very important, which is Zygmunt Bauman, in his great book, Modernity and the Holocaust, talks about how the smartest thing the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist.
Right.
Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. It's so much easier. Just put our heads down and go along.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, we put our heads down and go along, but then once in a while, we'll hold up a little sign.
Mm-hmm. And complain.
Or maybe, I just got an email from somebody who participated in an anti-war protest not very long ago, and she said that she was really disgusted because basically it was a big party. Basically everybody was just singing and dancing, and it's a chance to get together and feel good about yourself while accomplishing not very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got nothing against, you know, celebrating and feeling good, but the wolf's being killed, you know? Let's get down to it.
Right. You write a great deal about the violence that civilization has committed on us and on the earth. But yet some of us do fight back.
Yeah.
What makes us different?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I guess probably the answer is different for every one of us who fights back. And by us, I also mean, you know, the tigers who fight back and the salmon who fight back and everybody else who fights back too. I'm guessing that the answers are different for each of us on how it is that we woke up, how it is that we, you know, woke up from this nightmare. You know, what it was that that made it clear that the system's not redeemable, or even more fundamental, but if we're talking about fighting back, you know, if we're including fighting, if we don't just mean like taking up arms, we also, which, you know, when I talk about fighting back, I don't mean just blowing stuff up or whatever. I'm talking about everything, all forms of resistance, including the stuff we're making fun of the protests.
Mm-hmm.
I include that too. That's part of it. And so is filing lawsuits. And so is, you know, pouring through county zoning regulations to, you know, find a place where the developer's lying. So is, lobbying for that matter. So is, you know, I've got a friend who's a great activist, and the thing he's been doing for the last few years is doing those shareholder resolutions, which I actually don't think they're very useful, but it's his form of fighting back. And that's a really, you know, that's great. And that's really, that's important too. And so when I say fighting back there, I mean, I guess the question is, you know, how is it that some of us open up and we feel, and we, there we go, that's the answer right there. How is it that some of us open up and end up feeling? How is it that some of us, fall in love with the land where we live? How is it that some of us, what is it that makes some people fall in love with that? It's like, there's this line by this Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And why is it that some people, when they look at trees, they see dollar bills, and other people, when they look at trees, they see trees? And I don't know why some people resist at all, and I don't know why some people then, to take it a step further, I don't know why some people see that the system is irredeemable and resist more. I read something by one of the Black Panthers the other day, saying that when he joined the Black Panthers when he was 17, he knew that he was going to either end up dead or in prison. And what is it that makes a person go there?
You've written about hope in regard to reforming civilization, and you've said hope is harmful.
I don't want to reform civilization, by the way.
No. So you're saying hope is harmful when it comes to our goals.
Okay, let's back up a second.
Sure.
What are our goals?
What are our goals?
Yeah, what are your goals? What do you want?
You've talked about, and I agree with this, a world where every year there is more salmon, where there are more old-growth forests, where there's more spotted owls, for example. We're about to lose the last of our spotted owls here in Canada. If we want to stop that, then what do we have to do?
Okay, that's great. The first thing I think we have to do is figure out what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing we have to do, I think, is figure out what it takes for those creatures to survive. And it's pretty fundamental. I mean, what they need is habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, end of conversation.
Right.
I'll talk to you later. You know, it's like, that's really all they need. What do salmon need to survive? They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. I'm not saying they need for fishing to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for global warming to stop,
mm-hmm.
which means they need the industrial economy to stop.
Mm-hmm.
They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And each of those is pretty straightforward. I mean, what would we do if there were space aliens who were putting in all these dams and who were vacuuming the oceans? We would know what to do. So that's the first thing. I mean, the problem is so often when people say, what will it take for salmon to survive? What they mean is, what will it take for salmon to survive, given that we're not going to remove dams, we're not going to stop industrial logging, we're not going to stop industrial fishing? It's the same. What do spotted owls need to survive, given that, that we're going to allow all of their habitat to be clear cut? It's like, once again, what is primary and what is secondary? What's always considered primary is this culture. And is this culture's exploitation? And now, at long last, your question of hope. I think one of the things that we need to do first, there's false hope that I think needs to be eradicated. And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations. That's one of the reasons that the thing I was mentioning earlier about at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. They had the false hope that if they just go along, they won't get killed. And, my mother, one of the reasons she stayed with my father is because of the false hope that he would change.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the false hopes that bind us to the system? I mean, does anybody really think that Mac Lowe is going to, stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody think that Monsanto's going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what, you know, if we just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay. You know, it's like, what are the, you know, what are the false hopes that plagued us the system? And that's one start. And another start is that, or another part of this is that, it's not just people say we have to have hope, but I was bashing hope at a talk I did several years ago, and somebody out in the audience interrupted me to shout out, what is your definition of hope? And I didn't have one, so I asked them to define it. And the definition they came up with is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency.
Mm.
But I'm not interested in hope. What I'm interested in is agency.
Right.
I'm interested in us finding what we love and figuring out what it will take to defend our beloved and then doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think in addition to talking about resistance, I think there's also another way to look at this, which is community enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if we in our community decide that we are going to have a cancer-free zone,
mm-hmm.
and that we will do, and we're going to have a police force that enforces this and that shuts down every, you know, chemical refinery.
Right.
And this is what we are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course this would go against the government. It ends up being the same thing. It's resistance.
Yes.
But it's just another way to look at resistance. It's a way to reframe that discussion.
Right. And
which leads to the same thing, of course, of resistance against exploitation.
Right. And I see direct action as taking back that agency, that the end result mm-hmm. of civilization and social order has been that we are disempowered, we have no agency to act, or we're convinced that we don't. And when people
yep.
commit direct action, they're taking that back.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you're listening to Radio EcoShock.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's a huge, huge, huge thing, which is one of the reasons I think that so many of the Indians would fight back much more, is that I was just reading a quote by one Indian today, who's a Lakota man, I believe, who was saying that everything about our culture is aimed toward making us realize that it's our responsibility to figure out, it's our responsibility, what we need to do is to take responsibility for our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really crucial is that agency. And that's one of the things, of course, that's just entirely undercut. You know, we give up decision making to judges and attorneys. We give up communal protection to the police. We give up big scale decision making to politicians. You know, at every level, every step of the way, we cede responsibility
mm-hmm.
until I get a choice of working for, you know, IBM or Microsoft.
Not much of a choice.
No.
Coke or Pepsi.
Yeah. Well, certainly can't drink the water in the river anymore, can you?
Mm-mm. Derek Jensen, you're speaking in Vancouver on April 18th, and the title of your talk is Taking Action in a Culture of Violence. Now, tell us what we can expect from that.
Well, what I'll talk about primarily is the question, do you believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I ask that question to people all over the country, and nobody ever says yes. And if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. But, you know, I was doing a talk a few years ago, and it's actually a huge audience. We're all excited. Yeah, let's bring down civilization. Rah, rah, rah. It's like a rock concert, you know? And then at one point I just stopped and I said, okay, how many people in this room, in this theater actually, have ever filed a timber sale appeal? And it was me and one other person raised our hand. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, how many people have ever done any work like at a battered women's shelter? Maybe a half dozen women raised their hand. How many people have ever worked on a rape crisis hotline? 4 or 5 people. How many people have ever done any indigenous solidarity work? 3 or 4 people. And, you know, questions like that. And my point is that resistance and what I think is necessary runs the entire gamut. And I think we need all forms of resistance. We need many forms of resistance. Let me put it that way. But there's so much work. I mean, we need so much resistance, some of which is not sanctioned by the, you know, corporatocracy that runs everything. But at the same time, there is so much work that is absolutely positively legal and above ground that people simply aren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of that is that, you know, there's this develop, right? Calling them that, you know, because beautiful forests don't develop into you know, subdivisions.
Mm-hmm.
So this destroyer, you know, this guy wants to make a bunch of money. This outsider is what he is. He's not even that part of this neighborhood. He's trying to build a subdivision on 20 acres right near here. And we in the neighborhood have fought him for the last almost 2 years now. It's like 20 months. And, you know, nothing illegal has been done. You know, we haven't, you know, hit him in the head with a war club. We haven't, you know, slashed his tires. We haven't, you know, done anything at all. And what we've done is we've poured through county zoning regulations.
Mm-hmm.
We found the ways that he's lying.
Mm-hmm.
We beat him at the Planning Commission. We beat him at the Board of Supervisors. He's now taken it to California Department of Forestry. He said, if you won't let me put in the neighborhood, I'm going to clear cut. And so far, we're stopping him at CDF. And
mm-hmm.
and if we don't stop at CDF, we're going to sue him. You know, we're not going to... And my point is that's all legal, and
right.
a lot of it is really tedious,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it is just, you know, the game is, of course, rigged in their favor,
mm-hmm.
but, and frankly, the reason that we've been able to win with this guy so far is because he's so arrogant, he's so used to just walking over people, even in this pretty right-wing community, we're able to stop him so far.
They call it the paper monkey wrench.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any new books in the works?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So Endgame came out about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another book coming out in a month or so, which is an anti-zoo book.
Mm-hmm.
It's written with Karen Tweedy Holmes, the photographer. And it's coming out through No Voice Unheard. It's about a 150 page essay along with her amazing photograph. And then I have a book coming out next January from Seven Stories, called As the World Burns, 50 Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. It's a graphic novel done with Stephanie McMillan, who does the wonderful cartoon Minimum Security.
Mm-hmm.
And that book really started off as sort of poking fun at all those stupid 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Planet books that are just ridiculous, you know, and this idea that if we just, there's this line by Zygmunt Bauman where he says, rational people go quietly, meekly into the gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And I've changed that to be, rational people go quietly, meekly into the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that compact fluorescence will save the day. And so this book starts off there, and then ends up these aliens, these big space aliens, invade the planet, alien machines invade the planet, and they're going to consume every living thing. And they one of their waste products is gold, and so they give the president a bunch of gold to give them permits to eat everything on the planet. And since they have permits, it's all legal, so nobody can stop them. So, you know, the big green environmental organizations are like, maybe we can stop them on procedural grounds. And finally, they make a deal that the president will take the permits back from the aliens and give them back to the corporations, because of course the corporations are supposed to consume the planet, not aliens.
Right.
And in exchange for leaving behind 50 trees, 50 bushes, 50 rocks, 50 fish, those the environmentalists get. And the big green environmentalists are really happy with that deal. And then finally what happens, and I'm sort of going to ruin the end of the book. No, I'm not going to ruin the end of the book. People have to buy it. I'll tell you this much.
Okay.
That what happens is the wild animals start fighting back, then against the machines, and then there's not enough of them. They need help, so they send off the wind and the insects and the birds to fly out to ask help from the domesticates. And that includes the pets, and it includes, you know, domesticated cows. Some of them break out of field, and includes the domesticated humans. There's one scene I'm really pleased with near the end where there's a woman standing over a stove, and this plant in the windowsill says to her, "You're as pot-bound as I am. You know, let's go fight back. And when the fighting's done, you can plant me in the ground."
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "Why not?" She walks out of the house with her big, you know, big knife to go fight the machines. So there's that book, and then I wrote a couple other books a couple years ago that my agent has not been able to find a publisher for. I'll probably publish them myself. And right now I'm writing a book about shit. Oops, I can't say on the radio. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a book about feces.
Mm-hmm.
And how this culture has taken something that used to be a tremendous gift to the land base and turned into something poisonous. And how in a sustainable culture, including a non-human sustainable culture, all of your products are helpful to the land. There is no such thing as waste. That if I defecate, somebody else, slugs or flies or the soil itself, eats it.
Mm-hmm.
And this culture produces waste that are not useful but instead harmful. And how that's one more way to get at sustainability.
That's a lot of work that's going to be coming in the future.
Yeah. Mm. You know, I'm actually thinking that I'm really tired, and not just because I'm touring so much. I think I might take a couple months off this summer because, well, one, I've been really sick for the last couple years, and then also I've written, I think, 13 books or something in the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was thinking, you know, when I finish Endgame, I'm going to take a break. I finished it in November of whatever year that was. And then by the end of December, I'd written that anti-zoo book. And then in the next year, I wrote those two novels. And then, you know, it just goes on. I haven't taken a break in years. And I go back and forth because, you know, things are so, so desperate. And I can't stop, you know. And for a couple reasons, I can't stop. One is because things are so desperate and they're getting worse every day. And another reason is because I'm so in love, you know. I'm in love with. And that's what you do. If you love someone and they're being hurt or being killed, you do what you can. You don't rest. And then also, I'm very aware of my own mortality. And I don't want to die with 8 books still in me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to die and, you know, look back at the very last second and say, I wish I could have done more. I wish I could have done this much more to help the salmon. I wish I could have done, you know, this much more to help the redwood trees.
Right.
I want to die. When I die, I want to be spent.
Right.
And I want it to be like, you know how there's some days where you work really, really hard and then you go to sleep and you're so, so, so ready to go to sleep?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I want to die. It's like when, you know, it's like, you know what? I'm done. There's nothing else I can do.
Derek Denton, you'll be at Langara College on April 18th talking about taking action in a culture of violence. And thank you very much.
And on the
19th. You're going to be in Gibson's on April the 19th. And then also on the weekend, you're doing a special sustainability conference on Bowen Island. And all that information is on your website at www.derekjensen.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you very much for taking all the time with us today.
Oh, well, thank you. Your question's great.
All right. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thanks. I hope so, too.
That was author Derek Jensen, and I'm Zoe Blunt for Wild Earth Radio. Thanks for listening.